Thank you. I might even be under time on this talk as compared with the other two. And it's a rather more focused talk on the particular issue of resistance in outbreaks and resistance in epidemics, which is quite a different problem, as I'll show, from the issue of resistance and drug resistance to endemic diseases. In endemic diseases, really, you really are only talking about the relative fitness, given the certain level of treatment, of resistant versus sensitive types of a pathogen. In an outbreak and an epidemic, the situation becomes rather more complex because you only have a finite number of generations in the epidemic, and therefore the outcome is not quite as trivially related purely to the fitness difference of the two strains. But I'll put this in the context of influenza, where there's a particular applied interest, namely to do with the resistance to the neuraminidase inhibitors. Neuraminidase inhibitors like Tamiflu and Relenza, particularly Tamiflu, been widely stockpiled around the world for pandemic mitigation, mostly for use in treating clinical cases of influenza in the event of a severe pandemic, though some was used last year in a mild pandemic, but also potentially for prophylaxis, namely treating people who may have been exposed or have a risk of being exposed to a influenza case but are not yet showing symptoms. The challenge is that given the amount of drug which is stockpiled, in an influenza pandemic, if those stockpiles are used in a relatively short time, that level of usage of drug could impose a significant selective pressure on the virus. And so a variety of modeling studies around the world in the last few years have tried to look at this problem and ask, really, what is the risk of getting a transmissible fit-resistant virus spreading and starting to dominate over wild-type sensitive virus during a pandemic? And what would then be the impact of that, particularly clinically, but epidemiologically overall? And what I'm going to look at today is how the transmission dynamics of the virus associated with the timing and level of treatment affect the rate of emergence of resistance. But to start with, I'll just give a few slides on what we know about antivirals, their effectiveness, and their potential impact on particularly focusing on the impact on transmission of influenza during a pandemic. And I focus on the impact on transmission rather than the clinical impact, because, of course, the impact on transmission is in some sense, the fitness penalty drug imposes on virus, and therefore the selective pressure drug imposes on virus. So how do we quantify antiviral effectiveness? Well, many groups have done this. I'm using the terminology invented by Ira Longini and colleagues. Drug has three potential modes of action. One is if you treat somebody who is not yet infected, you can reduce their susceptibility to infection, as represented by this AVES quantity. So whilst somebody's on drug, they're less likely to become infected. In some sense, it's acting as a temporary vaccine. By infection, I mean they're less likely to seroconvert given exposure to the virus. And that would impose a selective pressure on on the virus to some extent to a resistant virus which emerges will have a significant fitness benefit in being able to infect those people on prophylaxis. Second, you have the clinical impact of antivirals, namely, if you're it's represented here, there are two types of clinical impact. This is actually a rather simplified representation, but conditional infection, so you've been infected and now you're treated. After you've been infected, what's the reduction in clinical disease? You could generalize what I put on there, AVEP. You could represent it more simply as saying what's the chance you've reduced your probability of generating influenza-like illness, or maybe you might want to quantify it by the reduction in the chance of being hospitalized or dying. We have some data on that from clinical trials, how much disease severity is reduced by treatment. And finally, there's reduction in infectiousness. If you're treated, then the drug reduces your viral load and therefore the shedding of virus and therefore your chance of infecting other individuals. A lot of work has gone on trying to analyze historical clinical trial data, try and estimate the values of these quantities. And previously, people have been using values of the type, you know, about 30% for the reduction in susceptibility, about 65% reduction in influenza-like illness, and 70% reduction of infectiousness. We spent some time, not yet published, but trying to reanalyze the trial data using a set of alternative models, and we came up with somewhat different parameters for reasonable natural history. And they give similar sorts of impact as the previous predictions, which I'll tell you about in a minute, but very slightly lower impacts of particularly antiviral treatment on transmission. So what does past modeling? I'm not going to go particularly into the details of the model. Well, I'll touch on it later in this talk, but the past pandemic modeling and the models I referred to yesterday, large-scale simulation models, what do those models tell you about the likely impact of neuraminidase inhibitors? I'm talking about treatment here. Well, the important thing to note about that is the curve on the right-hand side there, and this is, the red points represent viral shedding data from averaged across a cohort of patients. What the typical profile of viral load is expressed in nasal or secretions. And you see a strong peaking about 1 to 2 days after infection, corresponding to about the time symptoms develop in an infected individual, then a very rapid decay of shedding associated with the immune response. If you were to look at a symptom profile by comparison, then you would see a much more extended period of significant symptoms building up, perhaps peaking on day 3 and 4, and quite a gradual decline. So the viral shedding profile is much more concentrated. As I already said yesterday, that has consequences for the impact of treatment, that if you want to have a big impact on transmission, reducing infectiousness, and that's what the drug does, reduces replication of the virus, you need to get the drug into people really quickly after they develop symptoms, because viral load may already be peaking at that point. That's actually also true for the clinical impact, because the drug only acts to reduce viral replication. If you wait until day 3 or 4 and treat somebody, the clinical impact in terms of reducing symptoms will be almost negligible. They may still be symptomatic, but the drug is having almost no action. No. In influenza, virus doesn't really enter the blood. So people take nasal. Well, you can do a nasopharyngeal aspirate where you take a sample from the nose and then you look quantitatively. It used to be done with culture, now done with PCR. Look quantitatively at the amount of virus. I should say the blue curve here actually was obtained by fitting a generation time distribution to data from a cohort study undertaken in France, completely independent of the red points. And the reason I always plot them together is because they're close correspondents. There's another nice data. We assumed in these models that implicitly, well, that's what this comparison tells you, is that infectiousness is proportional to viral load, absolute numbers of virions per ml of sample rather than log viral load. But if you look in the literature, quite often viral load is plotted on a log scale. And so there has been this implicit assumption that somehow infectiousness may be related to log viral load. Or alternatively, historically, of course, when we didn't have quantitative PCR, when people just tested for the presence or absence of virus, then there was an assumption that for the whole duration of viral shedding, people were, quote, infectious, without nuancing that by saying how infectious there are. Ben Cowling's group in Hong Kong has done some nice work based on their cohort study, which is now more conclusively showing that it is, because they look at transmission in households and measure viral load, look that it's the absolute viral load, not the log viral load, which is predictive of infectiousness. So under that assumption, then you can say, first of all, if you treat people within 24 hours of them developing symptoms, then you might, in theory, for a pandemic which give a clinical attack rate of about one-third of the population, 34% or so, which corresponds to a reproduction number of about 1.7, then you might reduce that down to 29% through treating 90% of clinical cases. This is assuming that only about 50% of people who are infected develop clinical symptoms, something we know to be the case generally for influenza. So that's a very high level of treatment, and it's still only having a fairly marginal impact on transmission, because by the time, even when you're in that fairly prompt treatment, you're still, a lot of shedding has already occurred before you get drug into people. A second issue is how much drug do you need to deliver that policy? Well, that's quite a simple calculation. It turns out to be, if you stockpile enough for a quarter of the population and you're really quite good about not wasting drug and treating the right people, and that sort of stockpile size is about enough. If you wait longer than 24 hours, 48-hour delay, and I'll show you the actual results a bit later in the talk, you get very little benefit in terms of reducing transmission from treatment alone. What can give a much bigger impact on transmission is prophylaxis, because of course then you're treating people either straight after they've been infected but before they start really shedding virus, and you have a big impact in reducing viral replication, or you're treating people even before they've become infected and preventing infection. So, published in a couple of papers I did a few years ago, if you can implement household prophylaxis, again for a pandemic with a reproduction number of about 1.7, 1.8, then that policy can reduce overall illness attack rates by about one third. And most of that benefit is from reducing transmission. I mean, some of it is from just stopping people developing who've already been infected from developing symptoms. But of course, in order to implement that throughout an entire pandemic, you need a much larger stockpile of drug to avoid the risk of running out, and really probably a minimum of about 50% of population size. Not many countries in the world stockpile that much drug. The UK, France, and I think a couple of the Scandinavian countries were the exceptions. And the effectiveness, as I already said, is down to this early treatment of people and the blocking of infection and reducing the transmission. There can be a degree of wastage, because you can end up having to repeat prophylaxis for some groups where you get another case in the household. And you can, of course, undertake, and I won't go into all the details, a degree of sensitivity analysis in terms of these models, in terms of both treatment levels, whether you're treating only 50% of cases or 90%, and this is results with prophylaxis, shows you the baseline attack rate at the top for different reproduction numbers. I should say the clinical attack rate is roughly half the final size of coming out of the model, and the sort of reductions you can see. And potentially, if you're really getting in there really quickly, you can almost halve attack rates in some cases. Of course, in terms of pandemic planning, I should say those results and the results, very similar results Ira Longini's group generated in their work, have been really quite influential in determining policy in a number of European countries and the US in terms of what potential benefits antiviral treatment and prophylaxis might have particularly in a severe pandemic. Of course, last year, I mean, the UK was almost alone in offering universal treatment, partly because we had so much drug. Anyhow, but generally treatment levels were quite low because the disease was really quite mild. In terms of making this into a robust policy, we clearly don't want to rely on antiviral stockpiles alone. First of all, if we want to have antiviral treatment and perhaps prophylaxis as a valid policy option, you need firstly stockpile enough drug, and that really means about enough for 30 to 40% of the population size, and much more if you really want to be able to use household prophylaxis. And you need to allow for the, and this has really been illustrated last year, for the large levels of wastage. Because the disease was so mild last year that a lot of people in the UK who had mild respiratory illness were given Tamiflu, probably two-thirds, three-quarters of them didn't actually have influenza. And similarly, a large proportion of the people who really did have influenza never got Tamiflu. The limitations of antiviral treatment, and never mind prophylaxis as a policy in terms of its challenge of implementation, is why most countries have then considered layering on other interventions if the severity of a pandemic is merits it, and things like school closure, vaccines, other non-pharmaceutical interventions. And if you make fairly generous and optimistic assumptions, if you put everything in place, you might hope to see as much as a three-quarter reduction in attack rates in a pandemic. Anyway, That's just to set the scene for then asking the question, well, how robust are these conclusions to introducing the possibility of antiviral resistance into the model? And just a little bit of more kind of theoretical starting point, as I said in my opening remarks, the evolution of resistance during a closed epidemic is rather different in terms of its likely outcome and the relative role of fitness in determining that outcome than for endemic diseases. Because you have a finite size of the epidemic and a finite number of generations the resistant virus has to overwhelm the sensitive virus. So even if there's a big fitness difference, if you're only going to get 10 or 20 generations in the epidemic, the initial prevalence of the resistant virus is very important in determining an outcome. So the final proportion is fundamentally limited by that the number of generations the virus has to really catch up with the much more dominant wild type. Just shown here illustratively that even in the case where there's no fitness cost to resistance and you have a significant amount of treatment in the population giving a significant fitness benefit overall at population level to the resistant virus, still it takes a long time for the resistant virus to start dominating over wild type. So let's think about the selection pressure imposed by antivirals in more detail. More precisely, let's think about what are the opportunities a resistant virus has to infect people when a sensitive virus doesn't. Well, one is treatment of infected individuals clearly reduces their infectiousness, giving a fitness cost to sensitive type relative to a resistant virus where virus replication would continue unabated after treatment. Secondly, uninfected individuals who are prophylaxed have reduced susceptibility to sensitive but not to resistant virus. And a significant amount of past work has shown that because the fitness cost imposed on sensitive virus by treatment is much less than that imposed by prophylaxis, the results I've just shown you, it's likely that prophylaxis is going to select for resistance much more intensely than pure treatment would. There's some caveats to that I'll explain in a minute. So overall, in terms of antiviral resistance, we only expect resistance to be an issue in a pandemic because of those finite number of generations if a resistant strain can emerge with close to the same transmission fitness of wild type. And that will be my baseline worst case assumption in terms of the modeling results I show. That you get a transmissible, fit resistant virus emerge which, in the absence of treatment, has the same reproduction number as wild type. If you wind down the reproduction number of resistant virus in the absence of treatment compared with wild type, then of course you'll get less resistance. But you'll see from the results I present overall that the basic conclusions I draw is that it's quite hard under realistic treatment and prophylaxis scenarios for resistance to be a major issue during a pandemic. It may be selected for to a level that by once you the pandemic is ended and you go into kind of traditional seasonal flu, that drug no longer is particularly useful. But during a pandemic, resistance is unlikely to be an issue. But there are some challenges getting to that point. And one of them is that we don't really have much idea of the probability of a resistant strain evolving overall in the epidemic. But really, we want to quantify what's the risk per treated individual who's infected of them, the virus in that person mutating and generating a transmissible resistant strain. I'll do a back of the envelope calculation in a moment for trying to get a ballpark estimate, but it's difficult to quantify based on current data. So because of that, we can only really look at plausible kind of illustrative scenarios. And there are two different scenarios which are relevant considering. One is that, which doesn't require you to model the mutation process at all, just says that somewhere else in the world, before the pandemic reaches your country, maybe there's been intensive use, for instance, of antivirals in attempting containment, which is selected for some level of resistance, but then containment fails, and you're faced with the situation that you've got a mixture of viruses entering, seeding the pandemic in your population, probably the majority of them being sensitive to drug, but a minority being resistant. And I'll focus, most of the results I present will focus on that, because that's actually the more severe scenario. The second scenario is that the virus entering your country is completely sensitive, but that because of your use of drug, you select for resistance emerges through mutation and is then selected for in your country. How do we quantify the impact of resistance if it emerges? Well, there are three multiple measures you could use, but three obvious measures. One is, what's the proportion of all cases in a pandemic infected with resistant virus, the final size of the epidemic of resistant virus? And why we might be interested in that, I'm talking about clinical cases here, is that those cases will have a more severe outcome, given high levels of treatment, clinically, and probably higher levels of mortality, than the clinical cases infected with sensitive virus who are then susceptible for the effects of antiviral drug. And the second quantity is the total proportion of the population actually infected, instead of the clinical attack rate, the total final size with resistant virus, which may be different from the number of cases. And finally, in terms of the long-term life of these drugs, you might be interested in, even if the total amount of resistance you've seen in the epidemic is quite limited, if by the end of the epidemic you look at the relatively small pool of virus left, you have some ongoing transmission at a low level, but if a high proportion of that transmission is now with resistant virus, you've basically made your Tamiflu worthless in terms of later seasonal flu epidemics. I'll show, all the results, and you'd expect this, show that the final proportion, that final quantity, the final proportion of resistance always ends up being much higher than the total proportion of cases in an epidemic infected with resistant virus. There are reasons to say, particularly if we're considering very high levels of antiviral use in the event of a severe pandemic, saying that we don't care that much about the final proportion of resistance in the viral population. We care much more about how many people during the pandemic get infected or become clinically ill with an infection with that resistant virus. For the simple reason that once we have a vaccine available, even in the event of a severe pandemic, we can then vaccinate people and protect them, in some sense, properly against the disease. So antivirals are a stopgap until we have vaccine available. So the fact we've made our drug worthless in the long term is perhaps less of an issue than saving many lives in the short term in the event of a repeat of a 1918-like scenario. if we can save those lives and make then we may want to bear the cost of having a worthless drug at the end of a pandemic, given we'll have vaccine available. What do we know about the evolution, the possibility of getting fit, resistant strains of influenza? Well, until a few years ago, and I can't actually remember, I think it was about 2006, 2007, whilst you'd get occasional instances of seasonal flu viruses which would have clinical resistance, they would be resistant, they emerge in treated individuals, and those individuals would not respond to Tamiflu. There were very few instances of transmissible resistance ever being reported. And then something quite strange happened in 2007, namely we got a new strain of the old seasonal H1N1 virus, which had high level resistance against Tamiflu. Basically, Tamiflu didn't work against that virus and spread around the world very rapidly. It is very unclear whether that virus actually evolved because of selection pressure from drug. It was first isolated in Norway, and where there was almost no antiviral use, it is quite likely that it was just a random mutation of that particular codon position which gave resistance in the absence of selection for any selective pressure, and that hitchhiked on the back of other adaptive mutations and caused that mutation to be fixed in the population. The one country which did use a lot of Tamiflu before this event happened was Japan, where quite unusually, Tamiflu is a standard course of treatment for people with influenza-like illness and has been for many years, and probably is something close to maybe even 100 million courses over the last 10 years of Tamiflu have been used in the long term in Japan. And of course, because of that, there's been intensive monitoring for antiviral resistance in that country, but no real evidence of a transmissible FIT virus having emerged in that country. What about what we saw last year? Of course, there was a reasonable amount of Tamiflu used last year, particularly in countries like the UK and a few others. Again, it was fairly heavily used in Japan. Difficult to say exactly how many infected individuals were treated worldwide. Could be as low as 1 million, but probably closer to 10 million. And, of course, not all of those were tested for whether they developed resistance, but there was a fair amount of resistance testing done. Several thousand isolates, I think tens of thousands of isolates, tested and sequenced, and tested for antiviral resistance across the world. And so far, about 300 resistant isolates found. But importantly, none of those, there were very few instances of transmissible or apparently transmission of resistance. This shows the breakdown of those isolates, and the orange 6% of them were occurrence of resistant virus in an individual who had not been treated. 9% here. These individuals had resistant virus but had not been treated or prophylaxed, but may have been in contact with somebody who had received treatment. But for all the others, then resistance emerged in response to treatment, but it was not. There's no evidence that that then continued and that resistant virus was transmitted. As always, I should point out that a significant proportion of people who develop resistant virus are immunosuppressed individuals, because pathogenesis of influenza is much prolonged in such people. For instance, in AIDS patients, where whilst typically that viral shedding curve I showed you, most viral replication occurs over a 2 or 3 day period, in AIDS patients it can be extended to several weeks. And that, of course, gives much more possibility for resistance emerging. And most importantly, of course, last year, we saw no evidence of sustained transmission or the emergence of a resistant strain which is spreading in the population. So how might we guesstimate the frequency of de novo emergence of transmissible FIT resistant virus? Well, let's go back to that event in 2007, the emergence of the one example we've seen of a FIT transmissible strain of seasonal influenza, and let's assume that arose from treatment. And we'll assume that around 10 million H1N1, seasonal H1N1 infections have been treated with Tamiflu since the drug first became available, most of those treatment courses being used in Japan. And we'll assume, we have no evidence to the contrary, since the virus spread very effectively in 2007-08, that this FIT-resistant virus is as transmissible as sensitive. And because we're talking about seasonal flu, the effective reproduction number of a new seasonal flu strain is always quite low because of the high level of herd immunity, maybe about 1.1. And that means every time you get a FIT resistant strain emerging in an epidemic of seasonal flu, there's a roughly, and this is a very crude measure based on just the simple SIR model, but a roughly 1 minus 1 over R chance of that strain spreading, of getting a sizable outbreak, and that gives about a 10% chance of a significant outbreak or a long that emergent virus spreading in the population. And let's assume that because we're not testing that many people for resistance, we may have missed significant outbreaks, we only pick up 10% of outbreaks. Well, putting that together, that means you'd only expect to see the emergence of resistance in about 1 in 100 times. Taking that 10 to the 7 H1N1 infections treated with Tamiflu, dividing by 100, gives you a 1 in 100,000 chance for every treated case in a FIT-resistant virus emerging. You might therefore say that a range of 1 in 10,000 to 1 in a million chance per treated case of a FIT-resistant mutant emerging is reasonable. It could well be much lower than this, because that first assumption at the top may well not be the case, and almost certainly probably isn't the case. This ignores a whole set of other complex factors. The fact that this particular seasonal H1N1 strain emerged with this particular resistance mutation, typically in past seasonal influenza isolates, that resistance mutation carried a fitness cost. And it's arguable that there were compensatory changes, perhaps associated with reassortment of that virus with other viruses, that allowed that fit resistance strain to emerge. So it may not be a single-step mutation process, it may be a multiple-step process. And as I showed on the previous slide, that sort of range is kind of also reasonable from what we've seen last year, namely no real evidence of emergence of fit-resistant virus. So let's contrast those sort of numbers with what quite a lot of past modelling work has come up with. And I'm just highlighting a paper from Mark Lipsitch, published in PLOS Medicine in 2006, which was a very simple model, homogeneous mass action model, deterministic. They assumed a very high probability of de novo resistance emerging, 1 per 500 cases, then you get a fit resistant virus. And most importantly, they assumed implicitly instantaneous treatment, and therefore a very high selective pressure from using a certain amount of drug. And what they showed is that once you got up to significant fractions of the population treated, either prophylaxed or treated, because the model was so simple you couldn't really distinguish between the two, then certainly above 20% of the population of infected individuals treated, then you would end up with most of the epidemic being from resistant virus. A real concern. So that was rather great odds with the sort of results I was getting out of the large-scale simulation I've described earlier, where also it can model resistance and sensitive virus, which had much lower levels of resistance emerging. So I stepped back a little and tried to say, well, what explains those very large differences? And to do that, I went back to the simplest model you can really use to realistically describe the emergence of resistance to influenza in a pandemic. And that's a simple SIR household model. And I'll describe in the next slide a simple compartmental representation of that. And the reason you have to include households is because if you're talking about modeling prophylaxis, and household prophylaxis is really the form of prophylaxis most countries have considered in, then you have to incorporate the households. They're tight mixing units, a higher risk of transmission within them, and they're the units targeted for prophylaxis. And I just assume a fixed fraction of households receive treatment and potentially prophylaxis. Assume a constant R0, fixed, actually all households the same size, and I assume that transmission is more intense within households than between households. And most of the results I show you were for a UK-sized population. A little bit about the model. Of course, quite often people build simulation models to do this, but you can actually, for a simple household model like this, where you just have households and then global mass action transmission on top of that, I should say that's what I represent here, you've got transmission within households and then between household transmission events, you can actually write down these models much more simply than that, at least for a finite household size. Basically, you just track the number of households which have, at any point in time, I susceptibles in them, J people infected, and K people infected with sensitive virus, and K people infected with resistance virus. So you're tracking changes over time in the number of households in different infection states. You can ignore the recovered. And you have a number of infection terms. You have global infection terms equivalent to mass action with sensitive and resistant virus. And then you have the within household transmission terms, and then you just have simple recovery terms. It's simple to demonstrate the force of infection is just a sum over how some of those states, the Nijk multiplied by J, and then you're calculating the total number of infected individuals with either sensitive or resistant in the population. Now, in reality, the results I'll show use the stochastic equivalent of this compartmental model. It's simple to solve in Mathematica or Berkeley-Madonna. So let's consider first consider first the seeded resistance scenario, because this is always the more serious one. If you have resistance right at the start of your outbreak, then you're going to end up with more than if it has to emerge de novo. And the first kind of interesting and not completely intuitive result, at least wasn't for me when I saw it, is the dependence on the the total amount of resistance in the outbreak, the proportion of all cases in the epidemic which are resistant, on the reproduction number. And the basic conclusion is that that proportion, if you seed one, this is just for what, seeding 1%, when you start the epidemic, 99% of viruses in infected individuals are infected with sensitive, 1% with resistant virus. Well, if you have a high reproduction number at the 2 level, then you only end up overall in the epidemic with about 8-9% of individuals infected with resistant virus. But if the reproduction number is much lower, then that percentage can go up markedly. Well, why is this? Well, it's because given a certain selective advantage of the resistant virus, I should say, I assume that 50% of infections, namely the clinical cases, are being treated, and that they're being treated fast enough that the treatment reduces transmission from those individuals by 20%. The reason for the shape of this curve is that as you go up, the reproduction number goes up, it takes fewer and fewer generations of infection for the epidemic to complete. The epidemic is shorter in both chronological time in terms of numbers of generations. That means the resistant virus has much less opportunity to catch up with the sensitive virus. Whilst down here, remember last year we were in the kind of 1.4 range, the epidemic was much more extended, many more generations, so each generation allows a certain catch-up, certain amplification of resistant virus compared with sensitive virus, and you get more opportunity overall for resistance. You get quite similar results if you consider just de novo resistance. This is the epidemic is seeded completely with sensitive virus, but now we have a probability of, I think I assumed here, 1 in 10,000, quite a high probability per treated case of a fit resistant virus emerging. You get the same basic relationship as you go up to high reproduction numbers. It's only towards the peak of the epidemic that you have a high probability of resistance emerging, but then you haven't got many generations left for that resistant virus to really get amplified. I should say on these both of these curves here, you see the total proportion of the population infected as a function of the reproduction number as well, the final size. Those average results, and those were averaged over many, many simulations, hide a huge amount of variability. This is just for the seeded resistance case, where I'm seeding, I think I seeded the pandemic with, in 60 million people with, I think it was 100 infections at the start, or no, 1,000 infections at the start and 10 resistant infections. Well, the actual time course you get in terms of the proportion of cumulative cases which are resistant, kind of curve of the recovered curve in some sense of people who have been infected with resistant virus as a function of time, shows a huge amount of variability. Whilst the average may be hovering around 8 or 9%, the range is really quite marked. Because we're talking about small numbers of seeded cases at the start of the epidemic. And if you allow for de novo resistance, that variability is even greater. Another counterintuitive result, counterintuitive for me at least, was then how if you add to antiviral treatment, or for that matter prophylaxis, add to that non-pharmaceutical interventions, how does that affect your probability of emergence of resistance? So here I show a range of scenarios, just explain this graph. I'm assuming, first of all, a high level of treatment and prophylaxis. So here I'm assuming households are treated, a certain proportion, I think, of households are treated, and then they receive antiviral prophylaxis as well, which amplifies the selective pressure for resistance. But they also go into quarantine, and quarantine reduces the chance of one household transmitting to other households. And I scale the effectiveness of that quarantine from nothing at all to 100%. 100% means that an infected household prophylaxed won't transmit to any other household, no export of infection from that household. And then I look at a variety of scenarios for what proportion of households are you treating. You end up with quite an interesting result that if you start looking at the highest selecting pressure curve, you see a cutoff here, a very clear cutoff, that at the beginning, and you see it even more clearly on some of these curves, that as you increase quarantine, then you get a higher proportion of cases in your epidemic which are resistant. And that's because as you increase quarantine, you're reducing the reproduction number of the epidemic overall, and therefore the epidemic requires more generations to spread, and that gives more opportunity for resistance to spread. But as you make quarantine more and more effective, then you actually get quite close to the R equals 1 threshold, and of course then there's no opportunity for spread of either resistance or resistant virus at all in those treated households, and the total proportion of resistance plunges down. For lower levels of treatment, and let's drop down, for instance, and this level here is about 60% levels of treatment. Now, you're not treating enough people that you can really reduce the epidemic to a crawl and eliminate transmission, so even at 100% quarantine, but you see the same basic pattern. And there is a level of quarantine which maximizes the evolution of transmission. So it's not a simple argument that as you put in quarantine, you will automatically reduce the transmission and reduce resistance as a problem, which is what you might expect. At the higher levels of treatment, you can have the counterintuitive effect that because of the effect of quarantine, not reducing reproduction, but not reducing the reproduction, but by not enough, you actually amplify resistance. Of course, at the very low levels of treatment, you get the intuitive result that if you impose quarantine on those small proportion of households which are actually treated, you minimize the chance of resistance spreading. A second issue in terms of comparing more complex models with that very simple result, which said resistance was a real problem, a result highlighted by Mark Lipsitch and indeed many other groups, is the role of spatial structure. So if you just have a simple mass action model, then of course the whole population is mixing randomly, so if you get a cluster of resistance emerging, it can potentially affect anybody in the population. But in reality, people mix locally. And that means that a local community epidemic is really triggered by the first few cases in that community and can be, from that point onwards, almost considered as independent. Once transmission gets going, the relative contribution of homegrown endemic transmission to that particular community far outweighs the contribution of imported cases of infection into that community. And so the reason that's important is if you consider then splitting up a country into multiple independent patches, and again now randomly throwing seeded cases from outside the country onto those patches, a good fraction of those patches will never be seeded with resistant virus. And so most local epidemics will be local, and there will be a few patches which are unlucky and get seeded with resistant virus, which are more dominated by resistant virus. But the overall effect of this, if you do it, is you have quite a marked effect. So this is again the 50% treatment scenario, and I think with the reproduction number of 2, which if you seed with 1% resistance with just a single patch homogenous mixing, you get about 9% resistance. But if you split the population into 10 patches, now it drops to 5-6, and if you split the population into 100 patches, it drops even lower, down to just above the seeded fraction of resistance. And you see similar trends for the spread of de novo resistance. And the other aspect, the important aspect, is delays in starting treatment. And this has been commented nicely by a number of other papers. I particularly highlight that by Joe Wu and Stephen Riley, published in PLOS Medicine a while ago, which actually looked at this from a slightly different perspective. How do you minimize the spread of resistance in a realistic way by maybe sequencing different drugs? But the basic effect is the same. That because the level of amplification of resistance is so dependent on how many generations that resistant virus has to be amplified, and it will only be amplified if it has a selective advantage over sensitive virus, if you delay the period of time where you postpone the period until, not that sentence again, if you delay the period up to where the resistant virus will start having an advantage, then you reduce the total amount of resistance in the epidemic. And so one way of representing this is if you say, well, I'm not going to use drug at all, and this is very similar to paper by Mogadesh et al. if you delay the initiation of antiviral treatment in the population as a whole, you could start with one case, 10 cases, 100 cases, there were only after that thousandth or 10,000th case, you can have a really significant impact on the total amount of resistance. Because by the time, say, 10,000 or 100,000 cases have evolved, in terms of how many generations the epidemic has left, that's substantially reduced. Even though 100,000 infections is a small proportion of the total final size of the epidemic, it's a high proportion of the total number of generations, and that's what determines the ability of the virus, really, the resistant virus, to really outcompete the sensitive virus. And so you go from, again, 9% resistant virus overall in the pandemic down to as little as 2%. Now, of course, you can't really justifiably not treat people, particularly early in a pandemic when you're unsure about severity. But what you can do, and that's what Joe Wu and colleagues demonstrate in the PLOS Medicine paper, is perhaps use a different drug to start with. Maybe you might use Relenza at the start of a pandemic, which doesn't, the resistance mutations which affect Tamiflu don't necessarily affect Relenza, and then you save Tamiflu for the bulk of the epidemic. So all of those results point to the fact that resistance is less likely to be an issue when you put in realistic levels of treatment and selective pressure and some social and spatial structure in the population. Just in the last few slides, I'll show results from then the full spatial simulation model. I'm actually showing a simulation in the background of the whole of the European Union there. And just to re-emphasize, I know I've said this before, I mean, this model has the advantages over that simple model of having a realistic natural history, and now I'm representing as well as households, schools, and workplaces, and it's a spatially localized model with real travel data instead of just assuming completely decoupled patches. And I assume that into any population like Europe or the United States, there is a simple SEIR model in the background which seeds infection into those communities, and then also have realistic delays to treatment. And unlike the simple model as well, I'm representing clinical disease explicitly, and so I can capture all the different aspects of what treatment does to transmission and severity of disease. This reiterates the point that treatment alone in this model has to be very prompt to have a significant impact on clinical attack rates. So black is what you get is no treatment. This is clinical attack rate as a function of the reproduction number. In theory, you could reduce it by 20% or so if you treat people instantaneously, but a two-day delay, the red curve here, because you're already past the peak of infections, well past at that point, then the impact of treatment is negligible. So what does this simple model, or this more complex model, do in terms of predicting what risk resistance poses in a pandemic? Well, let's consider the absolute worst case, and it is really a theoretical worst case. Here I'm going to assume 100% of cases get instantaneous treatment or, and as an alternative, treatment and household prophylaxis from day one of their illness. So first I should say, in the absence of resistance in this model for the reproduction number I'm showing here, which I think is 1.7, you would expect, if you had no treatment at all, a 32% clinical attack rate. And if there's no resistance and you treat all the cases instantaneously, you can drop that to 24%, and if you add prophylaxis on top, you can drop it to 16%. Of course, you can't treat people that quickly, and you certainly can't treat everybody. But then you consider if you have the epidemic starting with 1% of infections entering the country a resistance, that impact, and represented by the graphs here, is substantially reduced. Instead of reducing the treatment-only scenario, instead of reducing the attack rate to 24%, now reduces it to 26%. And if you add prophylaxis on top, it actually has a negative impact, in the sense you get less of a reduction because of how much you're amplifying resistance, and you end up with a 28% clinical attack rate. More relevantly, what proportion of those cases are sensitive and resistant? Well, in a treatment-only scenario, by the end of the epidemic, 21% are resistant, and then when you add prophylaxis, a whopping 72% are resistant. So if you make very extreme assumptions, then you can amplify resistance markedly. But if you put in more realistic assumptions with a 60% of cases now being treated, more realistic in terms of how many we could actually get to, and treating people one day after the onset of symptoms, and assuming you don't actually pick up the epidemic entering your country immediately, you start after only 1,000 cases in the US-style population, now treatment-only scenario at those treatment levels barely amplifies resistance at all, given all the spatial heterogeneity effects and the low seeding level, and even if you add prophylaxis, you're only really doubling overall the amount of resistance you see at the end of the epidemic. If you consider de novo resistance, again, the complex model resembles the simpler model in the sense that resistance is generally less of a problem. That if you take the very unrealistic extreme scenario of instantaneous treatment of all cases from the first case in the United States and that 1 in 10,000 mutation rate, then by the end of the epidemic, if you only treat people, you get a 1% of the epidemic is resistant. And if you add prophylaxis, instead of getting 70% of the epidemic resistance, it's down to 30%. So it's a less of an issue. But if now you assume a lower mutation rate and that you don't pick up the epidemic immediately and don't roll out your antivirals immediately, you end up with tiny, tiny fractions of the epidemic resistance. So overall, whilst the simple, the very simplest models suggest that antiviral resistance could be a major issue in the next pandemic, if we have a severe pandemic and really use antivirals in the way we considered before last year, if you allow for spatial heterogeneity and a realistic level of either the de novo chance of resistance emerging and the selective pressure of actually treatment or prophylaxis, then the problem is likely to be much less than those simple models would suggest. I mean, the data from the simple household model and the full simulation do suggest you want to be cautious in rolling out very large-scale prophylaxis, because that will certainly select for resistance much more efficiently than treatment will. But you can potentially, if your treatment levels are still relatively low, there are scenarios where non-pharmaceutical interventions can potentially help, but they can also hinder if you're at a very high treatment level. So overall, in terms of realistic treatment levels, prophylaxis levels, and given scenarios about seeding, the best guess is that even with fairly high treatment and prophylaxis levels, antiviral resistance is unlikely to be a major problem, even in that sort of scenario, until quite close to the end of a pandemic. And then you're in the situation I outlined earlier, that you have to weigh up the benefits you gain from intensive use of antivirals in reducing morbidity and mortality early in a pandemic against the potential loss of utility of that drug later in the pandemic and for seasonal flu thereafter. And that really comes down to the judgment of how many lives you'll save as a function of how much drug you use versus the long-term cost of losing that drug from your arsenal. But bear in mind, the principal treatment, the principal intervention for seasonal flu, of course, is vaccination. And the main goal of antivirals in a pandemic is to buy time until vaccine is available. Thank you.